time set for our second case this morning, Gilliland versus State. We have Ms. Simpkins representing the appellant, Mr. Smith representing the respondent, the state of Nevada. Justice Silver and myself, Justice Gibbons are in Las Vegas in the courtroom. Justice Stiglitz is in Carson City in her chambers here. So we'll probably have some questions for both of you. Hopefully the audio works okay. We had a few technical glitches in the last one, but we were able to get through it. So we'll go ahead and proceed. Ms. Simpkins, I'll call upon you. And how much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, Your Honor.
Okay, very well. You should see the clock on your screen there, and you can just keep your eye on both sides, can keep your eye on the clock. So, Ms. Simpkins, you may proceed.
Thank you, Judge. With the court's permission, unless the court has any questions, I intend today to concentrate on the fair cross-section, the Batson, and the sufficiency of the evidence issues. With regard to the fair cross-section violation, how it was handled by the district court created problems. The challenge was initially made based upon race, on the race and ethnicity reports that we had subpoenaed prior to trial, which indicated that there were 4 African-American jurors on the panel of 65, which came out to a comparative disparity of 51.95%. But instead of following the required Morgan-Durin analysis, the court first compared the number of Caucasians and African-Americans on the panel to the number in the community and found that minorities were actually overrepresented on the jury. But when he was informed that this was not the proper analysis, the district court then deferred ruling and requested a written motion, which we'd never had that request before, but we complied. And he continued with the jury selection. So then the venue is brought in, and the state sees that there may be 5 African-Americans on the jury, so there's argument about that number, and this is based on their site determination. And that puts, if there are 5, puts the disparity at under 50%. So after going back and forth with the court, we did ask the district court to ask the question of the jurors, and the district court finally granted that request. And asked the jurors to self-identify. But the problem was he only asked the first 32 in a comparative disparity analysis supposed to be based on the entire panel. And 15 of those 32 changed their answers. Now, juror number 7, he's the problem here. He changed from African-American to undefined. Now, later on, although the court treated this as juror number 7 didn't want to talk about his race, so the court determined that he was African-American based on his answer to the jury questionnaire. The record reflects he only refused to answer questions about his family and talked openly about everything else. So if he's undefined, we've got a comparative disparity back over 50%, but we still have no ruling from the court. And the jury selection continues, and eventually juror 7 is struck by the state. But, you know, do we raise the Batson challenge or not? Because we still don't have a ruling on the fair cross-section challenge. So we raised the Batson challenge, and that was denied. The jury was chosen. They're informed that they're going to be the jury. And then the next morning is when we have the argument on the fair cross-section challenge. So the district court improperly denied that fair cross-section challenge because they were, number one, distinctive groups. There were 2 distinctive groups. We had African-Americans and Native Americans. Now, as to African-Americans, the comparative disparity of 51.95%, if the defense is correct, 39.92% if the state is correct. The question is, how do we determine a juror's race and ethnicity if they don't answer the question on the jury questionnaire? Sight is what the state argued at trial. We do it by sight, but I think that is completely wrong because I cannot assign a person's race and ethnicity based on my perception. So I think the best answer is going to have to be the juror questionnaire, and I submit that the district court should have then immediately decided that challenge because he had enough information before him to do that. The next best answer is asking the jurors. I mean, this is what we advocated for. But then the district court erred in releasing jurors without asking everyone that question. And we also run the risk of jurors changing their answers, which is exactly what happened here. So if we have a 51.95% comparative disparity, and you couple that with the total lack of Native Americans on the jury, which is 100% comparative disparity, based on this, this is strong evidence of underrepresentation. And the district court didn't substantially go past the comparative disparity analysis when it should have. We have 2 minorities underrepresented. They're not mutually exclusive. The point is to be inclusive, and we don't get to pick and choose which minority will be represented and which one won't. We also submitted evidence that the jury commissioner's office was not drawing from the required four sources at the time of trial. That law was changed, 6.045, was changed in 2017, and by 2019, at the time of trial, they were still not in compliance. And the district court here relied on several inappropriate things in determining that there was no systematic exclusion. First was the Battle decision, when he found that the number of sources that had been drawn on were appropriate, and that this court had found that there was no magic number of records. Battle was unpublished. It was decided before the change of N 6.045, and he's pretty much quoting directly from that decision. And then when the district court indicated that the sources that were drawn upon were appropriate and the statistics that come out of it indicate no systematic exclusion and relatively appropriate representation, there's no indication in the record what statistics the court was relying on. So I don't know where he got this information. And frankly, his ruling was incorrect. There are four sources that the jury commissioner, a government entity, is required to draw from, and that fourth source is also a government entity, which is required to provide the information. So we've got two government entities ignoring the law for 2 years. The reason the legislature included the unemployment division in the four sources from which the jury commissioner must draw is because minorities were underrepresented on panels, and including the unemployment division was an attempt to alleviate this problem. So at the time of trial, the fourth source was not being drawn from. And when the law is being ignored by government entities, we have systematic exclusion, and that is structural error. With regard to the Batson issue, because the process used by the district court in deciding the fair cross-section challenge created problems with the Batson challenge, we've got juror number 7. If he's considered undefined, that's not a cognizable group, and the Batson challenge fails. But if juror number 7 is considered African American, that is a cognizable group, and the defense did submit a prima facie case under Batson. Yes, Your Honor.
Just on the Batson piece. Let's say we agree with you at the first Batson objection was made, that the judge was wrong, that there was sufficient prima facie to meet the first step.
Okay.
Why wasn't that cured when there was a renewed Batson objection? And then the state gave its race-neutral reason. Like, why doesn't that, you know, for lack of a better term, fix that problem?
Well, I wouldn't address
not fix that problem, but give us a record to review.
They, at the time we argued the fair cross-section challenge, I renewed the Batson challenge, and they gave two reasons at that time. They gave the fact that juror number 7 nodded to Mr. Gilliland when he walked into the courtroom, and they gave the fact that juror number 7 had a prior conviction. So we take jurors at their word. So when juror number 7 indicated he had no animosity toward the state for his prior gross misdemeanor conviction of attempt grand larceny, which again is very dissimilar from what Mr. Gilliland was charged with, he also said he deserved what he got. And the state's reason for striking him, therefore, was belied by the record. And under Connor, when it's belied by the record, it's evidence of purposeful discrimination. And then the nod, we have one black man nodding to another black man, and that's culturally, racially significant and an improper reason under Batson. Juror number 7, he nodded to Mr. Gilliland, and because he was the only other brother in the room. So juror number 7 nodding to Mr. Gilliland is not a race-neutral reason for the strike. And I'd also like to note, the question to juror number 7 was, you nodded to Mr. Gilliland, do you know him? That district court had already asked that question of all the jurors, and there was nobody raising their hand. So nobody knew.
Ms. Simpson, I'm sorry. You're talking so fast. I wanted to bring something into that, what Justice Stiglitz just mentioned and how you answered it. And that leads me to mention the third prong. Don't we give great deference to the district court once the race neutral reason is given? And here it's because of the conviction and he served time. Certainly when we look at the hard record, you can see that he said, well, that's right, I can be fair and impartial. He did. And he said he deserved what he got. I mean, you know, on a cold record, it looks like he could be fair, but that's not our decision, right? Didn't the district court actually make a statement regarding the third prong and found that it wasn't pretextual of the state when it said that he could understand? I mean, he's the judge there watching everything.
Well, Your Honor, my recollection of the record is that the district court relied initially when the Batson challenge was made, the state declined to give a reason. And the district court then relied upon personal experience and started listing mm-hmm. reasons why he thought the DA's office would strike juror number seven. So there
yeah,
was
that you're right. That did strike me that the state didn't give it, that he literally right. gave the state's reasonings.
Exactly. And then once we renewed that objection, the district court did not address it any further. So when the state gave their reasons, he didn't make any further ruling on it. So
where is that in the record? Where is the second time in the record? And if you don't have it, that's fine. You can get it on rebuttal. Sorry.
I do have it. Court's indulgence. Okay. It is in volume 3, 440. Around page 445, I believe.
Say it one more time. Volume 3.
Volume 3, around page 445. And
thank you.
Yeah.
And you're saying that the district court did not make
right.
that third prong kind of statement as to why it wasn't pretextual.
That's correct. Okay. And it looks like I'm out of time, so if you have any further questions, I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Simpkins. Mr. Smith, on behalf of the state.
Good morning, Justices. Thank you for your time. Since Ms. Simpkins only really focused on the two issues of the Batson challenge and the cross-section challenge, I'll focus on that as well. The issue becomes this. Before we even see our jury panel and they subpoenaed those records, we have a number of people who do not answer that question. And I think the really big issue here is some people find that question particularly uncomfortable to answer, and they.
I'm sorry, I can hardly hear you. Can you really speak? I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
It's particularly an uncomfortable question for some people to answer, and so I think there are people who purposely leave that blank. So before we even know what our jury composition actually is, the defense tried to strike it. The state's argument was, well, let's wait and see. And indeed, after we get our panel in, one of the particular jurors appeared to be African-American. The state brought that up, and it was Ms. Henley who actually ends up on our jury. And Ms. Henley said, I identify as African-American. There was another change where one particular juror had answered African-American and then changes to, quote, undefined, which really isn't a racial group. So the issue then becomes, we tell a jury these questions that we're about to ask you is in order to determine whether or not you can be fair and impartial. And then we start asking them about what their racial identity is, which has nothing to do with whether or not they can be fair and impartial. And so it creates an uncomfortable atmosphere. And in fact, Mr. McElroy, which was juror number 12, was African-American, and he skipped that question after the judge had given him that particular list of questions that he had. And the court clerk reminded Mr. McElroy that he skipped that question, and his answer was, I'm black. And when he answered that question, and it's hard to discern from the record, but when he answered that question, it was clear he was either irritated or uncomfortable or something, just did not like being asked that question. But the fact of the matter is, once that jury panel entered the room, it was clear that we had well under a 50% disparity. And so we don't even, you know, Ms. Simpkins brought up the lack of use of other means like the unemployment office list, et cetera. You don't even get to that point unless you can satisfy prongs 1 and 2. And the only prong that was satisfied was prong number 1, which was a distinctive group. Prong number 2, if you go with the actual jury composition of the individuals in the room, there were 5 African American. And Ms. Simpkins has indicated that we have to rely on only what people say, and I don't think that's accurate. There is no legal basis for that. There has been no law cited to indicate that you must ask each juror their racial identity, and then whatever they say is what you go with. I think what, especially in that particular environment where it's uncomfortable, I think what the actual method that should be used, what I would encourage this court to consider, is if there is a dispute amongst the parties as to an individual's racial composition, perhaps at that time, on a break, or some other instance, not in front of everyone, address that with that particular juror. But to say that going by visualization is is not something that you can do. It's really a totality of the circumstances in order to identify, because the ultimate goal here is to make sure we have a fair cross-section. And Mr. Jonagan, who changed from undefined after answering African-American, and the other evidence that was available indicated that he was indeed African-American. There are 5 African-Americans, and the purpose of that rule was actually met. And so there wasn't enough of a comparative disparity in order to make that determination on whether there's a hearing on if the underrepresentation is systematic. And so I think it's a totality of the circumstances. And this is the first time that I have actually even run into a situation such as this where, you know, we ask each juror, I've never seen it before, where we ask each juror in front of everybody else, what is your racial identity, while we're questioning them on things we tell them. The purpose of this is to figure out whether or not you can be fair and impartial. And so it's probably not going to occur often where there's a dispute as to whether or not a particular prospective juror is indeed a member of a certain group. And moving on to the Batson issue, this is really a situation where appellant is trying to have, you know, throwing noodles against the wall and hoping something sticks. If this court agrees with Judge Johnson's determination that Mr. Jonagan was indeed African-American and he made that determination in the appropriate manner, well, then the appellant indicates that this court should reverse his conviction. But,
Mr. Smith, I mean, clearly, when you concede, the district court erred on prong one. I mean, you can read it, and he erred on prong one. He, got it confused with the fair cross-section under Morgan. So, I mean, are you saying to us that the district court didn't even error on prong one?
Yes, Justice Silver, if you look at, and the way the appellant has argued this is by using the word systematic exclusion, indicating that he has erred on prong one on whether or not there is a prima facie case. But when you look at page 414 of volume 2, the defense is the first, Ms. Coffey was the first person to actually use the term when they were trying to put forth their prima facie case of some sort of systematic exclusion. And Ms. Coffey says, at this point, we're making a Batson challenge based on the fact that I did not, based on the nature of the questioning, based on everything about him, I believe that we have a prima facie case for step one of a Batson challenge. That was the initial prima facie case argument that was made. The court replied and asked, okay, simply because he's African American? Then Ms. Coffey says, based on the pattern of who they did not question everyone, the fact that there was nothing in the questioning, the fact that they questioned him, not all the jurors that looked like this strike was motivated by race. That was the prima facie case that the defense was trying to make, and the word pattern of exclusion was initially said by the defense. And oftentimes,
So you're saying, you're telling this court that the district court didn't err on prong one based on whatever went back and forth. You're saying that the district court did not err on prong one.
I am, Justice. I am saying that on prong one of the prima facie case, now the issues that Ms. Simpkins brought up were when making that prima facie case that I just read to the court, those weren't brought up until appeal. And so this is the prima facie case that is being made before Judge Johnson, based upon everything about him, the nature of the questioning. And that is not a prima facie case of racial discrimination. Simply because the state used a peremptory strike against an African-American juror, by the way, which they had just argued was not African-American. And there's more evidence that challenge, the only reason that challenge was made was because the state used a peremptory strike against an African-American potential juror. Because in their briefing on page 22 in a footnote, this challenge was made out of, quote, an abundance of caution. Not because they felt that Mr. Jonagan was African-American and the state was engaging in purposeful discrimination, but because out of an abundance of caution. So again, there...
Mr. Smith, though, yes. I mean, it's made, that challenge is made after he nods. You ask why he nodded, and he says, because he's the only other brother in the room. I mean, that's part of the record. So you're saying that the defense didn't make a prima facie when you go to kick them on a peremptory?
I am saying that because when, and again, I've never seen someone, whatever race, walk into a courtroom and nod at the defendant. And so to say that that is not worthy of at least asking the question as to, we saw that you nodded, do you know him? Was there a reason for that? I think that is a legitimate avenue of question after that happens. And I don't think that that is some sort of evidence that the question is either racially motivated or that the peremptory strike is racially motivated. There were a total of four African-American potential jurors in the panel of 32. The state used a single strike on an African-American juror, and two African-Americans ended up on our jury. And the only, again...
Let me ask... Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to reiterate, the only evidence of a prima facie case that the defense gave Judge Johnson was based upon everything about him, based upon the nature of the questioning. No specifics at all. And so I would reiterate, Justice, that no, that is not a prima facie case. That there is racial, that the state is engaging in purposeful discrimination when exercising that strike.
Moving on to the state not turning over a videotape confession by the defendant. What's your position on that? Well, you clearly violated the discovery statutes and didn't turn over a videotape confession. And this is a life sentence.
Well, there are two points I would make to that. There was absolutely zero motion or argument before the district court regarding that. No motion for a mistrial and no objection, nothing of that nature. And what we have here is an argument about how this could have been beneficial based upon cross-examination questions. No further record was developed. So,
but you have a duty as a prosecutor, an ethical obligation to follow the statute, and you failed to do so. And that's big. It's a videotaped confession. And the best argument the state has is that they didn't make a motion for a mistrial?
No, Justice. I have two points to make. That is the first point. The second point is I could explain, because I was there, the issues and the reasons why and sort of the timeline of why that video wasn't produced. But Ms. Simpkins is not party to that. That was Ms. Coffey. So there's no record been made. And so anything that I would explain to you right now would just be me explaining to you from my recollection. And there is no way for Ms. Simpkins to contradict that. There's no possibility of that. My second point that I would make is the audio recorded was turned over, and so was the transcript. If this court finds that that was some kind of was error that has been shown through the record, I would say that that is a harmless error. Because even if you exclude that particular confession, we have another tape-recorded confession that was not done by the police that was introduced into evidence where the defendant admitted everything that he had done to this victim. And in that was a video recorder that was placed upon when the victim and her sister, which was the defendant's wife at the time, confronted him about what he had done, and he admitted it, and they recorded that conversation. And that conversation was also entered into evidence. So if you indicate that the video recording of that confession was error, it is harmless error, because even if you throw out the defendant's entire confession to the police, we still had a recorded confession that was made to another individual that was the victim and her sister.
Mr. Smith, you produced the audio of the interview, but the video was not produced, correct?
Right. The audio of the interview was produced, and the transcript of that audio was also produced. The video portion was not.
Was there anything in the video portion that I guess would have been relevant or would have informed the admissibility of it or the impact of it that wasn't present by the audio? Like, how are they prejudiced by having the audio of it, but not the video?
And again, Justice Siglich, I would reiterate, without a record being made, it's just my word about my recollection of what happened a year or two ago. I can't remember when the trial was. And
it looked like, Mr. Smith, am I correct that it looked like it was in the vault during the detective's testimony, and so neither side had seen it?
Correct. I did not see the video. It was an inadvertent, I had requested everything from the detective. I turned, and again, this is my recollection, and Ms. Coffey's not here, but I turned everything the detective provided for me. It was an inadvertent thing that happened. And so, again, the transcript was turned over. The audio of that interview was turned over. I cannot tell you what happened on that video, but what I can tell you is we have a completely other recorded confession which was not to the police and was also entered into evidence. And it looks like my time is about to expire unless the court has any other questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you.
Ms. Simpkins, you have, I believe, 4 minutes and 52 seconds.
Thank you, Judge. I know that asking, back to the Batson and the cross-section challenges, I know that asking these questions is an uncomfortable question. I agree with that. But there's a reason we have to ask this question, is so that my client can get a fair cross-section of his peers, which he is required to have by the Constitution. So we use the jury questionnaire when we ask them. We ask each juror, in this case, was asked in a list of questions. They were actually given a written list of questions. So to say that this angered the jurors or that makes them uncomfortable, this question wasn't singled out. It was floating around in the middle of a list of questions that these jurors were asked. And as far as the Batson challenge is concerned, prong one is very low. I don't think we have to be as specific as the state is advocating here. We had disparate questioning, and that is a reason for a Batson challenge. And I raised in my footnote in my brief, I said we raised this out of an abundance of caution, and that was very important why I put how the district court did things here. We didn't know how the district court was going to classify this juror in question. Was he undefined or was he African-American? I can't waive my client's rights. And if this is an issue, I have to raise it. So I raised it. And so we raised it. Ms. Coffey.
Ms. Simpkins, just
yes.
Briefly, the two proffered reasons, I think I'm on the renewal of the motion. So I'm moving just past the prima facie. The two proffered reasons have both been upheld in different courts and in federal circuit courts, supporting race neutral. One is, I think, the Fifth Circuit upheld smiling, the juror smiling at the defendant. So certainly, giving a nod and acknowledging the defendant could be something that's considered race neutral. Also, having been previously charged with a crime and incarcerated, especially by the same prosecutorial agency, has also been upheld, even where the juror says it's of no consequence. That doesn't matter, I deserved what I got or whatever. Those have both been upheld as race neutral reasons. So what in this record makes those different?
Well, as far as the nod is concerned, the major question asked by the state was, do you know Mr. Gilliland? And that question had already been asked by the district court. So presumably the state was aware that Mr. Gilliland had no relationship with this juror. And so when it elicited this race and culturally significant reason, I think that's what makes it a different situation. As far as the prior conviction. We have the Connor case, which basically indicates that if the reason is belied by the record, then that is presumed to be a prejudicial question. I know that's not the correct word, but that's the one that's coming to my mind right now. So I think that is the difference, too, here, because it is belied by the record that he would be prejudiced to the district attorney's office when he expresses he had no prejudice. He also talks about earlier in his voir dire that his brother had been, I believe, murdered, and that Metro handled that, and he was satisfied with how Metro handled that. So there's no indication that he's going to be prejudiced in any way against the district attorney's office. So that, I think, is my reasoning as to why this is a different situation. So And I would just take this opportunity to remind the court, I know that, you're aware of this, but a single strike is enough if it is racially motivated to per Batson challenge. With regard very briefly to the discovery issue and there being no objection or motion for mistrial, I would like to make the record clear. The defendant had clearly requested that his attorneys raise a suppression issue on his statement to the police, and that is reflected in Volume 1, page 116 through 118. That's discussed. So, and that is prior to trial, so I would submit that the state was aware that this was a concern of our client.
But Ms. Simpkins, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but on that point, if the state didn't have, when I say the state, the DA's office didn't have the videotape and was unaware of it because the detective never told them, is that a different situation? And I mean, I realize, is that in the record to your knowledge?
I read
a portion where he says he pops out with, yeah, it's in the vault. Uh-huh. And I mean, from that, there's a bench conference that they didn't get a copy of it. You see what I'm right. saying? Is it your understanding, or is it the record that the state or the DA didn't have a copy of it either from the police?
I don't know, Your Honor. I was, like Mr. Smith says, I was not the attorney. It was Ms. Coffey. But I can tell you that Ms. Coffey went to the DA's office, and she did a record. I know Mr. Pike did it as well. Ms. Coffey was under the impression that she had everything. What I'm saying is
the state was under the impression, it sounds like, that they had everything, or at least the DA's office.
Yeah, but the state has also the responsibility to make sure that they have everything from the police. I mean, we're dealing with, I have to go to the state. Metro's going to tell me to go pound sand if I go to them and say, I want all your evidence. Good. They're going to tell me to get it through the DA's office. So I'm in the position where they don't have it. They haven't done their due diligence to get it. The police clearly have it. That's not on the defense. That's on the state. So, and I think I'm out of
time. How is that statement exculpatory?
Your Honor, I do not know. I can't answer that question because I don't think it's a Brady violation. I think it is a statutory violation, and all that requires is a request. I don't think Brady necessarily applies here. And I didn't argue Brady. I did argue the statute. So if the court has any other questions, I believe I'm over time. So.
Okay, Ms. Simpkins, thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Smith, as well, for your excellent arguments and briefs today. Interesting issues here. We will take this case under submission, and we'll be in recess to our 11:30 a.m. for our next case.
Thank you, Your Honor.